is Donnie.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a twice weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I am the editor of Howler. Joining me in my tiny little studio in Miami is the only member of this podcast who, to date, has scored for Arsenal. He now works as a scout for the Gunners, Danny Carbassian. Hi, Danny.
How's it going, George?
Pretty well. Joining us from Bristol, England, not Connecticut, is the author of The Ball Is Round and Futebol Nation, two amazing books about soccer, David Goldblatt. Hi, David.
Good evening.
Okay. Man, we have a great show today because we get to talk about two of my favorite things, the U.S. national team advancing in a World Cup and Luis Suarez. We'll hear from Alexander Avnos, a Howler editor who, separate from that, is working this summer as a writer for USsoccer.com. He's sending us updates from the camp, and he joined us just hours after the Germany game for today's update. After that, we will talk about a major milestone in this World Cup, the end of the group stage. We'll look back at some of the most memorable moments from the opening part of this tournament and ahead to where it gets really serious in the knockout rounds. We'll also be joined by Shireen Ahmed. Shireen is a contributor for Muslim Women's Sports, and she runs the website Footy Bedsheets, probably the best named website of any soccer website. Ramadan starts on Saturday, and we'll talk to her about what that means for the two African teams left in the tournament, Algeria and France. So, a lot to get to, but Howler is an American soccer magazine, so there's only one thing we can start with, and that is USA-Germany. Man, okay, David, I know you were giving a keynote speech, a very important keynote speech in England today. You are one of the U.S. team's biggest boosters, but since you saw sort of a fragmented version of that game, I'm going to start with Danny. Danny, we lost this game, but it felt like a tie, a good tie.
It did, yeah. you know, we're through, which is the big bonus, basically, out of it. We took care of business in the first two games, as we wanted to do, and then we went into this game, you know, with a really good chance of going through, even if we did lose, which we did today. I thought, you know, based off the first two American games, we had a lot of joy going down the right-hand side with Fabian Johnson, and I thought Jurgen Klinsmann did a really good job tactically to change things for both games, even when Jose Altidore went out. Today, we definitely played the best team of the group, and Germany kind of showed it from the start. I think the first 20 minutes I looked at the screen and was wondering if we'd even had any possession at all because the Germans were so good at keeping the ball. I thought what the Germans did really well off the bat was get their fullbacks forward, and to us that kind of hurt us because we weren't able to retain possession at all in the start, and one of our major game plans in the first two games is getting Fabian Johnson to bomb up the right-hand side and create all sorts of problems on a counter. Well, when you don't have the ball, you can't bomb up the right-hand side. So,
well, you can, but it's just really ill-advised.
Exactly. It's very ill-advised. And I thought Jerome Boateng did, you know, it's crazy because Germany are actually playing with four center backs right now at the back in their 4-5-1, which I think might actually be a problem further down the line because they might get exposed eventually with quicker guys that can play down the flanks. But Jerome Boateng got up the right-hand side really well. Lukas Podolski was even getting up the left and putting dangerous crosses into the box. And I just thought it was difficult for us to settle initially. And their midfield are fantastic and are able to keep the ball and turn defense into attack really quickly. So it took a little bit for us to settle.
So one thing that struck me about this lineup, you know, Klinsmann, I think, has done a pretty good job with the players available to him. One thing that struck me is that, you know, a 5-year-old could have told you that the U.S. would not have the majority of possession in this game, and yet we didn't set up a team that was really capable of playing on the counterattack. Brad Davis on the left, Graham Zusi on the right, not our speediest attackers. A lot of the attack comes from the fullbacks who were pinned back for most of the game. And then, you know, Clint Dempsey up top, who I would guarantee you Klinsmann has told the team not to play a bunch of long balls into him because just the chances, you know, A, it's not really his game. B, the chances of him getting sort of smashed in the face with an elbow when he goes up for one of those is really high, and we all know he has a broken nose. So I didn't really understand what the game plan was. We also saw Michael Bradley playing a really advanced position again, at times the most advanced player on the field for the U.S., and I think that we can all agree that that is not his best position, based on the three games we've seen him play in the World Cup. What did you discern any sort of coherent game plan from this? Like, what's going on? Brad Davis on the left, Zusi on the right, you know, Beckerman and Jones holding, which I think, again, we can all agree is a good idea. They've played very well. But what else is going on here?
I think from the U.S. point of view, it was just have guys kind of flood the middle of the pitch and hope for the best. And I know it's not just hope for the best, but yeah, if you did look at the game, there wasn't much of a game plan. I think we were very reactive this game as opposed to being quite proactive in the previous games, where we were kind of able to, as I said, dictate play kind of down that. And when I keep mentioning Fabian Johnson is because that's where most of our joy came out of from the first two games. Today, us unable to get that joy, Michael Bradley kind of pushing up high. And another, I think, reason that the Germans had so much joy today was the fact that their midfielders are able to do small things technically just much better than the Americans are. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Germany's one of the best teams in the world.
You saw that
and
with first touches a lot, I think.
A lot of the first touches, yeah. And what the Germans are really good at doing is they'll receive the ball on their front foot. So when we were attacking and their defense won the ball, the first pass would be into an Ozil or a Kroos or
just your
just
typical
your standard just issue midfielders. Yeah, exactly. Right. Schweinsteiger, all these guys, he filled in. And their first touch is on their front foot, so they're already turned. They let the ball roll across their body, and they're already turned. And that next pass is another entrance pass into another more advanced guy. So they're already on the break. And I thought today in particular, we struggled with that a little bit. I thought Michael Bradley at times, he'd get the ball, it would be a sluggish touch, and then we'd get caught out, and then Germany would have the ball again. I thought Jermaine Jones did a good job of, when he does get the ball, even if he's under pressure, he'll get his body in the way and then win a foul. So at least we still retain possession to that extent. Mm-hmm. But the Germans are just so good at quickly transitioning. When they lose the ball or when they win the ball back, they just quickly transition, and the next pass is into the opposition third, and they're attacking again. And I thought our defense had the trickiest game today because of all the movement of the attackers as well as Mueller, who was up there playing as a false nine again today.
So Klinsmann made another change with the central defense. This is now the third setup we've seen in this tournament. You know, the first was through injury, Brooks coming on, but he took out Jeff Cameron and put in Omar Gonzalez. I thought after the first sort of whiff that Omar had that was sort of very dangerously close to an own goal in our own six-yard box, he actually played really well. Do you think that was a tactical maneuver? I mean, did he anticipate a lot of balls coming in that Omar could win in the air? Or is Cameron being punished for the mistake he made that gave away the first goal to Ghana? Or is there something else that I'm maybe not even considering here?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. Maybe he's punishing Jeff Cameron because, I mean, Jeff was, I suppose you could say, directly at fault for the two goals against Portugal. Throwing Omar Gonzalez into the third and final group stage as your full World Cup debut from the start is pretty gutsy from Klinsmann, I thought, and Omar was quite shaky from the start, you know, that first clearance. I found it kind of interesting. Maybe Klinsmann thought that Klose would start, so there would be a pretty big aerial threat, as opposed to Mueller, who, as you saw, drifted quite wide at times and gave our center backs problems, because when you do play a false nine, Mueller would go out wide, and Taylor Twellman pointed out even, he said, see, this is what happens when you play a false nine. Mueller's out wide, and then there's nobody in the box. And then Mueller beats his man and puts a ball on Ozil, who has a chance on goal because they have so many attacking guys in the box. So that was kind of funny to hear Twellman, like, kind of criticize the false nine and then say, well, there's Ozil right there. I think Omar, it's a good game to play Omar because, once again, it is. I mean, this was the toughest game that the U.S. would have played. Moving forward, I'm not sure whether he goes back to Jeff Cameron or leaves Omar in there. The next game against Belgium will be another very difficult test. I think today Romelu Lukaku, I don't think he started. He'll likely come back into the lineup. He hasn't had the best of World Cups, but he'll likely come back. He's a huge aerial threat, and we'll have to be prepared for that. So,
David, there are three players right now with four goals in the World Cup. Messi, Neymar, and Thomas Mueller. one of those is not like the others. Have you ever seen a great goal scorer who's as boring? I mean, just as Clint, I mean, he just shows up in the right place, but he doesn't score these highlight reel goals like the other two.
No, but, you know, given the number of goals that England managed to score, it would be pretty good to have that dude up front. I think we could probably accommodate him. One can be occasionally instrumental about these things. We can't all do beauty. You know, and it's also just more of a, it is more of a team effort, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but the Germans are really playing like a team. And, you know, particularly Brazil, I think, are very heavily relying on Neymar to give them something a little bit different. That's why I think Germany looks so good, because they really are playing, you know, it's an 11 person team.
Okay, so I want to leave it there. We will have a preview of the next US game, which is on Tuesday, in the next podcast, because we'll be recording that on Monday night. So we're going to head off to Alexander Abnos, who is sending in his report from Recife.
Hey everybody, how's it going? This is Alex Abnos coming to you from the Arena Pernambuco Media Center. I just got down after talking to some players and some coaches after the U.S. Lost to Germany 1-0. However, it's about as good of a loss as they could hope for. It puts them through to the next round. As for this game, I think something that happened before the game that might have directly affected just the way the U.S. came out were the extremely rainy conditions. I was in the van on the way to the stadium, and the streets just were a flood sometimes. The van that I was in, you know, the exhaust started getting back up into the car because there was no place for it to go because half the car was submerged in water. It's kind of miraculous that we made it here, and it's kind of miraculous that anybody made it here at all, considering those were the conditions inside of town. What's notable about that also is that it prevented a lot of the players' friends and family from getting here. So right before the game, instead of focusing on the task at hand, they're worrying about their friends or their family or whoever came along with them on the trip to Brazil. And I think that, you know, Clint Dempsey suggested in his press conference that might have distracted the players a little bit and might have contributed to their slow start. However, after a really rough 25 minutes where Germany had all the possession and all the chances, the U.S. kind of started to settle into themselves a little bit, even if they struggled in the final third to create attacking opportunities. However, they can look at it with a positive viewpoint. They're going from a pretty tricky game, both in terms of actually getting to the stadium and also in terms of knowing what they want out of it. They didn't know quite going in whether, you know, a win would be best or a draw would be best. Now they're in the second round, and the job is simple. You have to win the game. So that simplifies things a lot for the players, allows them to concentrate just on the game and playing it and doing everything they can to win. And I think for this group, that's probably for the best. You know, it's not the most experienced group, and making things as simple as possible, Jürgen Klinsmann said, is always going to be a more preferable situation. That's all for me for now. I got to go catch a flight. This is Alex Abnos signing off from Brazil.
Okay, so the group stages are over. The knockout stages are here, or about to be, after a quick break on Friday. What an amazing opening stage of the tournament. I don't even know if we'll get to talk about anything else, because I want to spend the whole time talking about Luis Suarez. David, were you watching when he bit Chiellini on the shoulder?
Oh, I sure was. And for a moment, I think, like a lot of folks, I went, that was a headbutt? And then you just knew that he'd had another little nip.
I've taken a lot of flack on Twitter for saying that I really like Luis Suarez and that I don't think that he's the Antichrist.
I mean, like, of course he's not. I mean, is he someone who's got anger management issues? Yes. Is he someone who is not really in charge of himself a lot of the time? Yes. You know, does that make him the Antichrist? No. I also think there's a real, the biting thing. I don't know whether you're picking this up, but there's a real cultural taboo issue around biting. And I've, you know, it's like, actually, would I rather get a nip in the shoulder, or would I rather get a really painful, you know, drag of studs on my ankle and be put out for the next three games?
I mean, I totally agree with you. I think the fact that Nigel de Jong is still playing in workplaces across Europe is, by which I mean stadiums, of course, is a very dangerous thing. It's like you're putting hundreds of soccer players at risk every time he steps onto the, you know, every season that he plays. And yet he's, you know, he hasn't been banned for anything like 9 games for taking people out of the knees or doing anything else like that.
Can I say one thing real quick? I think one thing that's interesting about the Suarez thing, though, too, is the fact that, like, when you see, like, guys that you mentioned, Nigel de Jong, guys like even Pepe, where something is initiated and then, like, there's a kick in the game or something, like, the Suarez biting happens, like, off the ball when it's just... The first one happened in when he was at Ajax, and the first one happened...
during, like, a melee. Like
it was a melee, yeah. So there was, like, some aggression there, but, like... The Branislav Ivanovic one happened in the box. All of a sudden Ivanovic is down and just like, what just happened? And then this one, kind of the same thing. It's like, wait, did he just headbutt him or what happened?
You know, when he said that thing, the racist slur to Evra, I think one of the things that people who were more sympathetic to Suarez, you know, maybe apologists for Suarez were saying was that, you know, he's not really a racist. He was doing it to get in his head. Look, I have no idea what Suarez was trying to do. But, okay, it strikes me as not premeditated, sort of in the moment. Like, he's just goes red in the brain for a second and bites at someone. But maybe, is it a tactic to throw the opponent off? Because it certainly works.
That's what Ruud van Nistelrooy said immediately after the game. He said, it's so unfair because... then he gets bit, nothing happens, and then you have to defend a corner, and it's like, you just feel, it's like unfair.
Is he gonna bite me again?
I just got, well, no, it's just like, Chiellini's mindset is that, like, what the heck, like, I just got bit, and this guy's still on the field, and nothing has happened, and then right. They score the goal.
Yeah, but getting bit, get kind of like, it messes with your head more than getting kind of clunked on the ankle. I mean, I think there's something here about, you know, human beings don't want to be eaten by other creatures, particularly other human beings, and there is... that's just something about it, right?
No, it's totally, it's a taboo thing, which is why I think, you know, the previous suspension, I believe I'm right in saying this, the previous longest suspension for an act committed during the World Cup was, I forget who it was, David, you might remember.
The dude who broke someone's nose.
Yeah, it was an elbow to the head in the 1994 World Cup, right?
Yeah.
This is longer, and yet the damages were less.
Yeah, but it is number three. I mean, you know, this is the third, and I think that's kind of, that's part of the thinking here. And I think it's reasonable because in the end, you really like, you know, bless you, Luis Suarez, you bring me joy and pleasure in many ways, but you really, really got to stop biting people. This is not acceptable. I think it's like, it's fair enough.
I don't know if you guys saw today, there was a stat on Twitter saying that since 2010 he's missed 34 games because of these bans without actually getting a single red card, which is like
that is amazing.
Amazing, right?
That's a skill. If only there weren't video cameras all over the place. Someone should tell them that these games are on TV and that there are literally 34 cameras or something like that in these FIFA World Cup stadiums, and that he's not going to get away. He went down as though Chiellini's shoulder had fouled him in the mouth. I think that was a great tweet that I saw. I want to talk about CONCACAF. CONCACAF has, out of 16 teams left in this tournament, 3 of them, almost a quarter, are from CONCACAF. That is absurd. It's crazy. Like there's no way that should happen, and yet it has. Danny, Mexico shouldn't have even qualified for the World Cup. What is going on here?
Yeah, so Mexico shouldn't have even qualified for the World Cup, probably, and they nearly won their group had they had, you know, just a little bit better game against Brazil, which is nuts. And Costa Rica winning their group, a group that we definitely didn't see. I don't think any. I mean, apart from some Costa Ricans, probably didn't see many of them getting out of their group. And then the U.S. even almost winning their group, you know, to an extent. But it's great for soccer. It's great for soccer here. It kind of shows just how strong CONCACAF is as well, which is great because I think a lot of people when they look at U.S. qualifying at times, they kind of discount how difficult it is to actually get to the World Cup. And having Mexico, Costa Rica, and the U.S. all get out of their groups and into the next round has been great for us.
Totally, and not only are almost a quarter of the teams from CONCACAF, almost a third of the MLS players who started out in the World Cup are left in the tournament. 14 out of 22. 10 for the U.S., 3 for Costa Rica, and Julio Cesar of Brazil, of course, who may be the first current MLS player to win the World Cup. That would be amazing. Looking ahead, I think we all agree that Mexico had an easier draw in the group stage than the U.S., but I would say that Mexico has a harder round of 16 opponent in the Netherlands than the U.S. does in Belgium.
Yeah, the Netherlands are obviously going to be very, very, very difficult team to beat, and they've shown already this tournament they've definitely got goals in them and can score when they get things going. The U.S. faced Belgium, which I think Belgium's a side that hasn't really kind of hit it up a notch. Really, they're a very good team individually, and they can be a very good team as a team as well. And we saw that last year when they beat us 4-2. The way they played that day was very different from what we've seen at the World Cup so far. Which, and if you look at the results, actually, they're scoring goals very late in the game as well. You know, they won all three games, but all three games they scored late and kind of had to figure it out in the second part of the second half of each game. So it's not the worst draw in the World Cup, but it won't be easy. I think
you're right.
Can I just say on the CONCACAF issue? How fantastic it is that CONCACAF's moment of triumph cannot be enjoyed by either Jack Warner or Chuck Blazer.
Righteous justice.
let's just dwell on that at the moment, because it wouldn't be good if Jack Warner was crowing over this moment. So this is a good thing.
Not only is Saturday the beginning of the knockout stages, it's also the beginning of Ramadan. That means practicing Muslims are expected to fast, meaning no food or water during all daylight hours during the month. Great for focusing on the spiritual side of life, not so great for winning an elite sporting competition, maybe. Next, we'll talk to our friend Shireen Ahmed. She is a lot of things, but among them, she is a Muslim, a soccer player, and a soccer coach. And she will be telling us about the challenges faced by Muslim players in the soccer world. Shireen Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us on Dummy.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I know that you are of Pakistani descent and you live in Canada. Neither of those countries are in the World Cup. Who are you going for this year?
Well, as of this exact moment, I'm forced with Algeria, Iran being eliminated yesterday, and Bosnia. So I'm going fully with Algeria.
Now, Ramadan starts on Saturday. So first of all, can you give a very brief explanation of what the players will be expected to do differently now that Ramadan's starting, and how that might affect them in the tournament?
Well, basically, in the month of Ramadan, from sunrise, which at this point is, I think, 4 in the morning, depending on where you are, until sunset, which can, you know, is around 9 o'clock, 9 p.m., there's no ingestion of food or of water at all, or intravenous drugs or anything. Let's just say if you needed an IV, you would be omitted from fasting. So the players won't be taking in anything. Now, before you begin the fast, most people either go to bed with a really big meal or they wake up to perform some prayers and they eat at that time. So if the players were playing a game, say noonish or 4, they probably would have been fasting for anywhere from 8 to 12 hours at that point.
So even like you come in for halftime and you're gassed and you need some liquids to replenish, they can't take on water.
No, they can wash their face. They can rinse their mouth out a couple times, drench themselves in water, but no, they can't actually swallow any of it, no.
Is this not a medical liability? I'm just curious about, you know, it would be such a tragedy to see a player collapse on the field because heat stroke or just exhaustion. What sort of safeguards are in place for someone who's exerting themselves like this?
Recently, there's been a lot of research into athletes and players fasting, and keeping in mind that this isn't the first time that athletes have ever performed at a high level. I don't know if you remember, but Hakeem Olajuwon used to play for the Houston Rockets during Ramadan in the NBA Finals, and he won his championship the year he was fasting. So, I mean, there's precedent for this and public precedent. Now, what it is in terms of medical, like I have a good friend that actually did her research, a PhD thesis from Marshall University on this exact thing in physiology, and saying that the research suggests that energy intake or body mass change during Ramadan, and what happens is carbohydrate and protein metabolism aren't significantly affected during that peak performance time. So the important thing is after you finish your match and after you're allowed to eat and drink again, to hydrate yourself sufficiently at that point. So the risk of dehydration actually runs not heat stroke, dehydration, two different things, runs if you've gone for a lengthy period of time without replenishing fluid.
Even though I come from a family with, you know, Iranian and Pakistani heritage, I've spent a lot more time around Catholics, and I know that during Lent, if someone slips up and has that piece of chocolate or whatever, they're sort of like, yeah, you know, no big deal. Is there a lot of variation in how seriously different Muslims take this period? And is there any chance that maybe the players are just maybe not abiding by these laws?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's also important to keep in mind that Muslims aren't a monolith. Like, they're coming from different countries around the world. The way that the Algeria team would approach it might be different than the way the Muslims from Bosnia or from Belgium or, you know, from South America would approach it. And there are different dispensations sometimes, different countries, due to the traveling involved in the World Cup. Some, there's just dispensations that you don't actually have to do fast while you're traveling. Now, I know that the Ivory Coast had been eliminated, but both Yaya and Kolo Touré had committed to fasting while they were playing. They publicly said that. So it depends on the player and their perspective of whether they intend to continue. And their teams are well-versed in support and medical and physiological support and emotional and spiritual support. It depends on the player and depends how they approach it.
I know you cited your friend's research. I understand that. Okay, so I should say I don't really understand the body all that well compared to like a physiologist. But I have to imagine that there's some disadvantage at not being able to take on water. You're a soccer player. What I'm saying is I'm not trying to question whether or not that's accurate because I haven't read it. I'm not sure. But I do wonder if there might be an advantage to a team whose players are doing something collectively for like a religious reason. Could there be an advantage to that, where they maybe would perform better because they are sacrificing or something, and they know that they're making some sort of collective sacrifice?
And I think that's a really important question, and I'm not sure of the different opinions of each squad. I know that on France, Karim Benzema, for example, he commits to fasting, and although Frank Ribery is not on the squad, he would as well. But collectively, like, I'm not sure. It depends what each player's own position is on it. Like, some might be, some might not be. But in terms of an advantage, I am a player, and I do fast, and I always fast when I'm playing. I mean, it's exhausting, but you're exhausting when you give 100% on the pitch anyway. And I've been really lucky. My games are in the evening, so quite often I'll take a couple of dates and some water. And at halftime, or when it's time, I will go to the sideline, I'll sub off for a minute, and I'll get what I need, and then I keep going. And it's also important to keep in mind, this isn't the first time or the first occasion where these players have done it. For most of their adult lives, probably, they've fasted and played and trained. Maybe not in tournaments as big as this. I know for Algeria, it's the first time they've qualified for the knockout round. So this is a really big deal, but they're professional athletes. Like, they're accustomed to doing this. And religion for Muslims is not something you sort of put in your pocket and walk about if you're observant. It's a part of your life and who you are and how you live. So they're pretty well versed in this.
That was Shireen Ahmed. Her work has been featured on The Huffington Post and Policy Mike, and you can follow her website, Tales from a Hijabi Footballer, at footybedsheets.tumblr.com. Let's take another quick break, and we will be back with Tiki Talka. All right, we're almost out of time here, but before we go, let's do our Tiki Talka segment where we bring up our favorite things from the soccer world over the past few days. Danny, let's start with you.
So this is non-World Cup related, but certainly soccer related, and we're heading for France for this one. But a club team in France called Clermont Foot 63 hired a Portuguese woman to manage their team at the end of last season.
They're in the lower leagues.
Yeah, I think they're second or third division, exactly. Uh-huh. Her name is Helena Costa. She's 36 years old, and she's been dubbed as Mourinho in a skirt, actually.
That's an image.
Yeah, exactly. So she was hired as this club team to be their manager, and she reported to training on Tuesday for her first day of training, and abruptly resigned from the team.
Hours later.
Hours later, exactly. And apparently what had happened was she'd emailed the club kind of disgruntled about the fact that they'd gone behind her back and signed a bunch of players, arranged a bunch of friendlies, which are things that the manager should be responsible for, especially coming into your first season. She's very unhappy. She actually emailed the technical director of the club multiple times throughout the week, and apparently the technical director emailed her back saying, "You're tiring me with your messages." So that's really put her off. So as fast as we've had the first female professional men's coach, we've seemingly lost her as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's pretty disrespectful.
Very disrespectful.
David, how about you?
I'm going to go with a beautiful thing, which was today the Ghanaian goalkeeper made a sensational save from a Ronaldo header quite close. And the header was so strong, it threw him back over the line and he sort of lay crumpled on the ground. And then he looked up just for a moment and saw that the coast was clear and the ball had been cleared. And he leapt to his feet and punched the air with pleasure. And, yeah, that was just a very, very sweet little moment.
Probably had so much power because of the thunderbolt that's been shaved into the side of Ronaldo's head. Whether that's to commemorate a scar from a cancer patient or not, I think that we can all agree that that gives you extra power when you're heading the ball. My tiki-taka is the Ann Coulter piece that has been making the rounds on the internet today. She is the queen of trolling everyone. Just like a professional troll, just a terrible, a terrible person. Let's just put it out there. And what I really enjoyed, and I don't want anybody to go and read this because every time someone clicks on it, she like there's like this little cha-ching sound that probably she has in an app or something, and it just puts money in her pocket. But I do want to say that we're constantly here in the U.S. talking about, oh, has soccer made it? Oh, you know, what's the status of the game here? And I've been doing some appearances on TV and radio. It seems like, you know, I did one and then it sort of snowballs and people are like, oh, let's get that guy. And they all want to ask me the same thing. It's like, hey, the U.S. doesn't really like soccer. So what's going on here? And I always tell them the same thing. It's in a country of 300 million people, a subculture can be pretty giant. And, you know, there are tens of millions of soccer fans living in this country. You know, if Ann Coulter if soccer's on her radar and she is hating on it, that's okay with me. I don't want her to start liking it. Then I'll have to find something else to do because I don't want to be in her club. But I just wanted to call her out and say thank you for doing what you do about soccer. It just really validates. I just feel personally validated by that. It's a nice feeling. David, I know you had some thoughts on that. Do you want to add anything?
Oh, man. I'm sharpening my pen. I haven't read it, but I can't wait to see what she has to say. I suspect, to be honest, you know, it's not new for far-right characters and polemicists in America to decry soccer. I mean, if you look back to the 94 World Cup and even more recently, and not just on Fox News, there's a lot of people, you know, going down the un-American, unmanly line. And in that respect, I don't want to give her too much kind of oxygen because we've been here before, but I sense actually a bit of panic in their voices, and I like to hear panic in those guys' voices.
Yeah, the last thing I want to say about this is I tweeted something about it earlier, and my friend Ishan Tharoor, who's a writer for the Washington Post, got back to me on Twitter, and he said something, and he linked to a piece he had written that he actually just published this morning about why soccer seems to panic the right in this country. And I thought he made a really interesting point that I had not actually considered yet. And I want to just read this one line from his piece. He writes that the U.S. team may not be an elite force, but it has time, resources, and demographics on its side. And while it may never be the swaggering American hegemon of the 20th century, it sure looks like something of an idealized American 21st century, industrious, cosmopolitan, and more aware of its limitations on the global stage. And I thought that was a really interesting insight into the psyche of the American right and all the things that sort of freak them out, the decline of the U.S., the fact that we may have to share or ask permission to do things or may not be the best at something. And those are things that are represented by the U.S. And the U.S. soccer team does struggle and doesn't always get its way, very famously doesn't always get its way. And I think that's one of the reasons that a soccer stadium is one of the few places that I'm okay chanting USA, USA, because we are the underdogs in this respect. And I think that that's a really great thing to keep in mind. So I thought that was a really interesting point.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, to me, my time in the US, particularly amongst the students that I've taught, you know, for a lot of young Americans of all ethnicities, if you want to check the rest of the world out, if you want to have a kind of cosmopolitan attitude to this planet, if you want to engage and discover the rest of the world, then man, soccer's just, it's the way. And this, you know, the US at the World Cup, seems to be just delivering on that promise, because it's not just fabulous entertainment and brilliant drama. I see a kind of unruly, unplanned, spontaneous little reimagining of what it means to be American in the 21st century, and how great that it's the football stadium that the play, that that's the crucible in which that can happen.
Totally. Well said. I think that does it for this episode of Dummy. I want to thank our guest, Shireen Ahmed, for her great insight on Ramadan and the Muslim faith in soccer. Thanks also to our esteemed panelists, David Goldblatt and Danny Carbassian, for joining us. Alexander Avnos for sharing his crazy journey with the U.S. men's national team all summer. Thanks to Slate, and particularly the guys over at Hang Up and Listen, Josh Levine, Mike Volo, and Andy Bowers, for having us on board for the tournament. Most of all, we want to thank you. If you like what you hear, make sure you tune in for our next episode Tuesday. And if you haven't followed us on Twitter, you should. We're at What a Howler. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Malena Barajas. My name is George Kureishi, and I'll be back on Tuesday along with the rest of these dummies. Until then, happy World Cup.